evening, weebs of all walks. This is Byron D Zero, and you're listening to the Weeb Trash Can Podcast. How y'all doing?
We good.
See, that's the Byron.
Yeah, there we go. You got your energy back.
Shut up. All right.
He stole it from me. I'm super low energy today.
Yeah, I guess so.
Oh, God. Mechanical shutting down.
Yeah, you got one of my generators.
Get this man some sugar. Luckily, there's plenty in front of us.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah, so before we get started, let's tell everybody who you are.
All right, sure. You already introduced yourself, so Mag will be here. What's going on, guys?
Mechanical here's trying out solar panels. I need to stay out of the shade.
Oh, no.
Sounds like you're a little burned. Megatron here with the smoothest voice, bringing heaven straight to your ears.
Oh, yeah. So today's going to be a fun episode. For most of y'all don't know, we are all connoisseurs of various forms of animation, not just the Japanese type. I'm pretty sure everybody in this room has grown up on some variation of Western shows.
Yep.
Some good, some not so good. We've seen the high points, we've seen the low points. Mm-hmm. So today, I want us to talk about a little bit of an overlap. Western shows, Western animation that has been influenced by anime. There have been various attempts at it in the past. Some of them were cool, some of them not so cool. Some of them were tongue-in-cheek. Some of them did great justice to them. And I'm going to get this ball rolling with talking about one that is near and dear to my heart, Steven Universe.
Yeah.
I love me some Steven Universe.
So much.
Wasn't it like one of the first ones to have like an actual trans character? American-wise?
So, yes and no. It's not so much trans as a lot of gender fluidity.
Yeah.
Because there's this whole race of alien beings are all essentially female, but they can't assume whatever form they choose to assume.
Yes, because they are shapeshifters.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So, for the five of you who have never heard of this show, because clearly, if you're listening to this, you haven't heard of Steven Universe, you must be living under a rock.
Oh my God, it's such a good show.
Yes.
Like, I'm just going to be interrupting you this whole time to put in my two cents worth.
Oh, no, that's fine.
Obsessed with Steven Universe.
So, I won't go in too heavy into the lore, because I don't want to spoil the experience for anyone that's been thinking about this. Steven Universe is about the titular character, Steven, who is the child of Rose Quartz, who is the leader of a revolutionary army of alien gem-like creatures called the Crystal Gems. And she ended up sacrificing her existence to bring her son into being. It's a lot more complex than that, but that's the story I'm going with.
He's half human.
Yes, and he's half magic.
Yes, he is half this, he is half gem and half human, which makes him a unique being.
Yes.
And you get to watch his struggles growing up, not just as, you know, the coming of age story, but the coming of age as a half alien child.
Yes.
Sounds like being half Mexican.
Yeah.
But with more superpowers.
I really don't want to avoid talking too much about the story because It would be too spoilery, but...
Oh my God, crazy. Yeah, there's... But, why did you pick it for, being influenced by anime?
Well, one of the main reasons is because the story structure. It has a lot of the art storytelling features of anime. And Rebecca Sugar has borrowed various tropes from anime, like enemies, more so in shonen anime, where enemies becoming friends.
Mm-hmm.
Big reveals about characters that you didn't see coming until, like, halfway through the series.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like in another series that I'm sure one of us will be talking about later. But back to Steven Universe. Even, like, just the aesthetic of some of these characters. They look like something that you would see from, like, maybe even a modern Japanese animator. It's a special show on a number of reasons. Like, one, representation is big here.
My God.
So much representation. Like you mentioned earlier, a lot of the characters are gender fluid.
Mm-hmm.
They're, it, like, gems aren't male or female. They just are.
They all sort of present as female, though. That's, female is the default.
Yes.
So you basically have, to the outside casual observer, three queer women raising a child.
Yes. It also brings a new dynamic to the relationship of Steven's dad, Greg Universe, and his mother. Because Greg knew all the stuff about Rose Quartz, including the fact that she wasn't necessarily female, quote unquote, but he loved her nonetheless. So it kind of raises the question, was he pansexual? You know,
that's not something I've ever really thought about, because there's so much else going into the show, but, I mean, sure, because Rose Quartz only ever manifested as her chosen form around him, which was, honestly, the female, like, ideal, and in the like, Mother Gaia kind of form. She's a very, very large, she's kind of like a giant woman, and she's straight hourglass, she's built.
I just want to see you form into a giant
woman. Oh my god, no, she's a brick house, she really is. She's built like an ancient Mother Gaia kind of figure.
Yes. Right. She's super maternal, and you see a lot of that go into Steven's character. Which, there is a really fascinating video essay from Pop Culture Detective Agency on YouTube, which I highly recommend anyone listening to this podcast to watch, talking about the subversive boyhood of Steven.
Mm.
Where he breaks away from a lot of these manhood tropes of punching first and thinking later. He parallels Usagi, where, like, when everyone else has lost faith in the enemy or in person, she would still try to see the best in them. You saw that in going to Sailor Moon with his relationship with Hotaru when she was reborn. And you see that with Steven with every enemy that he meets. He's like, I don't want to kill them. I don't want to shatter them. There has to be another way.
Yeah. No, he's a hardcore pacifist, but not just in that violence isn't the way, but in that he just so legitimately cares about everyone.
Yes.
Which is an interesting, I wanted to bring up a couple of, bring it back to comparing it to anime stuff. There's some fun animation stuff that you talked about. Steven often literally gets stars in his eyes.
Yes.
His like pupils turn into stars, which is very anime. And he has a lot of background shows going on that are straight anime, which are hysterical. The like, what's playing on the TV in the background of the show is all hyper anime and very funny.
And the music. I love this show's soundtrack, ever-growing soundtrack so much. Rebecca Sugar, the creator of the show, is a master songwriter.
Mm.
And you see, like, you hear that with like some of the more thought-provoking songs in the show. Like, there's one that one of the voice actors and very world-renowned recording artist, Estelle Darling, does, called Here Comes a Thought.
Mm.
Which,
that was the one I was going to mention. Like, I cried when I, basically, they explain anxiety and how to deal with it in a very approachable manner.
I actually listen to that song a lot when I'm going through an episode. I'll just, like, hum it to myself. I remember I was in a coffee shop the other day, and I'm just like, all of these things seem to matter so much.
Oh, so good. The other one that constantly gets stuck in my head is Stronger Than You, which I can't really talk about the premise because it's a huge spoiler. But recently, this episode's going to come out way after it happened, but recently, Boston Comic Con was in town, Fan Expo Boston now, and we had all of the major Steven Universe voice actors there. It was incredible.
I met all
but,
of them, too.
Oh, I didn't get to. I was working. I was very upset. But the entire week before, weekend of, and week after, I had friggin' Stronger Than You stuck in my head, just playing on repeat.
That's another thing about Steven Universe that I absolutely adore. The dedication from the cast. They love their fans. Yeah. They love what they're doing. And the message is not lost on any of them. And that's what makes this show so special, is, like, there's so much positivity in it.
Steven Universe is nothing but positivity in the face of nothing but adversity.
Absolutely.
And it's incredible. But again, we could have an entire episode just raving about Steven Universe, but we got to keep it on topic about why it's specifically influenced by anime, by Japanese, which I feel like we've kind of covered. Is there anything else you wanted to...
Again, going at the soundtrack, how a lot of anime soundtracks are sold, and they usually are chart toppers.
Mm-hmm. Cookie Cat.
Yes! Yay, Cookie Cat!
That's on the very first soundtrack, and now that...
It was episode one.
Yes, it was.
Episode one had Cookie Cat.
He
left his family behind!
I've actually joked about making Cookie Cats for some of my kids that I work with. But that would be too much work, even though I'd love to do it. Moving on with that, though, there is just so much more I can say about this, but I will have to do a standalone recording at some point about that.
So, I'll just say, as an outsider looking in, watching YouTube gush about this has been really cute. I'll hold it for
you. It's an incredible show, and anyone who hasn't watched it should.
I do want to add one more thing.
Duly noted.
With the voice acting, some of the more recent additions to this cast have been massive recording stars in their own right. I'm not going to spoil who these two big Broadway stars are, but one of them is Pamela Pond. She plays one of the first big bads, and she's well-renowned in musical theater.
Mm-hmm.
And that just shows me that how much Rebecca Sugar loves musical theater, and I feel like if we ever had a chance to hang out, we'd have a lot to talk about. But I'm done.
The gush valve has been sealed.
Yes, we're gonna turn that off for just a moment, and move on to I guess I'll gush for a little bit.
You and Will gush.
Huh? Yes. No, that's true. I'm I wasn't sure what I wanted to talk about, but then I remembered how everything changed when the Fire Nation attacked.
God damn it.
Yes, I'm going to talk about Avatar The Last Airbender, because you want to talk about obvious choices for Western animation.
Right.
Like, it was literally America's response to, this anime thing seems to be doing real well. Let's see if we can do the anime. Yeah. And they did the anime.
Oh, yeah,
and they did it real well.
Yep.
Very, very good.
That's wonderful.
So, yes, everything about this series is anime. This is them trying to create anime by Westerners for Westerners, sort of, because it's also, there's a lot of Eastern culture jam-packed into this show, which is really cool. First off, the animation style is straight out of, is like Miyazaki.
Yes.
Almost like
the creators have actually gone on record saying that was their biggest inspiration.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And you can see it. The cultural aspects that go into it, all of the different bendings, each bending style is based on a different form of martial arts, which is super cool to watch.
Yeah, so you got Tai Chi, you got Home Guard, you've got, Tiger Style, and you've got, I think, Dragon Style, too?
Tai Chi is airbending.
Yeah.
Which makes a lot of sense because it's the forms that they chose so perfectly match with the elements that they chose to pair them with.
Yep.
It's very, very good.
You got Hungar, which is earth, because you can tell by their very, like, deep stances.
Yeah, deep stances, they really do the, like, stomping, the strength.
Yeah, of course.
Everything about them is about strength and... I don't want to say immobility, but...
It's more like, it's like being solidarity.
Solid, yes, solidarity, yes.
That's what it's all about.
Solid movements.
Yeah. Well, because they're trying to channel the earth beneath them.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Earth is the most stubborn of elements.
Nope. And then you have the water bending. I'm not sure if it's... I think fire is tiger style, and I'm not sure... I'm not 100% sure if it's dragon style for water, but water...
Could be crane.
Yeah, it could be
I could look this up right now, but I'm not crazy familiar with the types of real life martial arts, but I remember Nickelodeon like doing a special about the Earth, the bending styles are based on these real martial arts styles. And it was pretty cool. I remember watching that and being like, yeah, I like this. So yeah, you've got the martial arts style. You've got a lot of really interesting specific episodes that are very much homages to certain tropes.
Yes.
I've been rewatching this series this week. And I've gotten all the way through book one, which is water. And I've gotten most of the way through book two, which is earth. And I haven't gotten to book three yet, but believe me, I'm deep in now. I've watched this whole series before, but it's been fascinating to rewatch it because it has been years. And there's an episode where Zuko literally has a lone samurai standoff.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. Yeah. And I was watching this going, oh shit. Like when this was on TV, this trope did not click with me. Now that I'm older and I've watched so many more things, consumed so many media, I was able to really pick out these tropes that I was watching, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that particular episode really did emanate Kurosawa.
Oh yes. My god, super Kurosawa, super Kurosawa. And here's the thing, is people forget about that episode because it is the episode where we learn about Zuko's past.
Yeah.
And it's through a series of flashbacks, and that's the part that people remember, not the present day storyline that's going on. As I was watching, I was like, I remember learning about Zuko's past, and I remember this story, and I remember this trauma, and I completely forgot about the Kurosawa happening in the samurai showdown happening in the present day. And I was like, dude, this is amazing. How did I forget about this?
The close-up of the Avatar.
Yeah. Oh my god, it was great. So yeah, everything about Avatar The Last Airbender is super-duper anime.
Heavily influenced.
Heavily, like, is anime that just happens to have been made in a Western studio. And I do have to mention, so you know, we get through Avatar, and many, many years later, surprise, we get more Avatar. Yes. We get Korra. Excuse me. We get Legend of Korra, which is about his... No.
Isn't it great-granddaughter?
No. They're not related. It's his next incarnation.
Yes. Okay.
Korra is... So the Avatar is very much a one-to-one parallel of the Buddha, where he is reincarnated into every life and is found in every life by picking a series of toys that belonged to him in his previous lives. And they specifically talk about this, and this is how they find the Buddha in each of his lives. Or, the Buddha? Gandhi? No, shoot, I'm...
It was
Buddha. Sorry.
Buddha.
Yeah, Buddha, that's what I thought. I had a moment. I doubted myself for a moment. So they literally, it's a one-to-one parallel with the reincarnation cycle and how they find the Avatar in each life. And they talk about that in Aang's flashbacks in the original show. The next show, Legend of Korra, is about Korra, who is a water tribe person, and she is the next incarnation of the Avatar. And we come in, the whole plot line of The Last Airbender is Aang learning each of the elements that he needs to master so that he can defeat the Fire Lord and bring peace and balance to the world. Korra is born into a world now where they have established peace, and she basically is born with just these superpowers. She immediately masters everything. Like, they find her, I'm getting to it, they find her as a toddler in the water tribe, and they're like, oh, well, how do we know this is the Avatar? And she busts in as a toddler, firebend, waterbend, like, rock, earthbend, I am the Avatar! And it's hysterical.
Yes.
It's hysterical. She buzzes through all of learning these, and book one picks up with her needing to learn the final element, air. And she has a lot of trouble with this. She has a lot of trouble with air.
Well, that was the thing in, like, with each Avatar, though, like, they always had one element that they did not have an affinity for.
Yeah. Yeah, for Aang, it was,
It was fuego.
Well, partially fire. He had a lot of trouble with earth, when he eventually, because he picked up fire very quickly, but he got scared of it because he didn't have the control, and he immediately, he picked it up like that, but he burned Katar.
Yes.
And so he picked it up quickly, but then got scared of it. Earth was what he really, really struggled with, which is the opposite of air.
Yes.
Okay.
That makes sense. Yeah. Yes. Because I literally just rewatched this.
Hey, no, by now you are the subject matter expert.
So anyways, yeah. So Korra is interesting because it still has the animation style of anime and it has some of the tropes, but it actually leans a little more towards, like, steampunk diesel punk.
Yeah, it's more modern.
Yeah, which is really interesting watching because they still have all of the clear anime influences in the animation and in some of the character tropes, but for the next generation, they leaned into the newer popular media, which was more steampunk.
Mm-hmm. Sorry to butt in, but didn't the Fire Nation first invade the Water Nation in the first episode with steamships?
Yes, there are definitely, there are elements of that for sure.
It's like crude tech. So it's more like if you were to call it a type of punk, it'd be coal. Not necessarily.
Yeah.
It'd be more refined.
No. So the Fire Nation, basically, their ships are powered off of coal. Yeah.
Okay.
And they're big metal monstrosities. But the Fire Nation's technology is not the focus of the series, and it is not the aesthetic of any of the background stuff. Like, even once you get to the Fire Nation, all of their architecture is very traditionally Japanese. Versus when you get into Korra, you come in and you have an announcer man who does this sort of recap every single time. Yeah. And it sets the tone. Yeah. And you see these cities that have been totally rebuilt.
Trains.
And that traditional Eastern architecture is gone. It's all been replaced with super steampunk. Granted, kind of Eastern looking steampunk.
Yeah, like Chinatown steampunk.
Yeah,
like,
but definitely.
Turn of the century.
So it's really fascinating to watch both of these series that have been so directly inspired by anime, and then watch the second iteration of it be inspired by the more recent subculture.
There is so much taken from both of these properties.
I did not even get into, like, the emotional stuff and the character journeys, and especially, so I've been rewatching The Last Airbender, and you see all these struggles with war and peace and personal values versus wartime values and all this stuff. Korra takes those personal struggles to the next level.
Oh, absolutely. I was going to say it kind of makes it internal as opposed to external.
Yes.
War is more inside.
Exactly, because Aang is dealing with an external threat and dealing with his internal struggle, but you see Korra born into a world of peace, and so her struggles become more internally based, struggling with identity, and then later on, I mean, identity becomes huge because there are some things that happen that change her entire outlook on life, which,
the last few books really...
Holy cow. Yeah, and the last two books are more focused on her struggle with world peace and balance, is finding balance between the physical world and the spiritual world.
Yeah.
Versus Aang had a little bit of spiritual stuff that he had to work with, but it was mostly him coming to terms with the spiritual world so that he could access the Avatar state.
Right.
Versus the spirit world and the physical world in Korra are completely out of balance.
Yes.
And that's her primary objective, is to try and stop that conflict. And she does it in a very unexpected and very interesting way. I guess we've established that we're not going to get too into spoilery things.
Well, but that's why there's so much tech involved in Legend of Korra, because
it's an incredible foil against man-made versus the spiritual stuff. It really does. Not only does it bring in viewership because that was the popular subculture of the time, but it also really drives home the man versus spirit.
Yes.
Which was incredible. And also in both series, you want to talk about, you know, Eastern influence, the way that humans interact with the spirit world in both series is very much Eastern ideals rather than Western. You have, exactly, and you have a whole spirit world. You don't have, like, heaven and hell. You have a whole separate spirit world, and you have all these little spirit creatures that can interact and come back and forth, and it's very, very much based on the Eastern idea of the spirit world versus the Western.
Yes.
There are little interesting things, like the conversation in Last Airbender between Bumi and Aang, talking about the idea of the Jing.
Yes. Yes, I watched that episode today. Well, I was at work. I had it playing in my earbud, so I wasn't really watching. I've been re-listening to it just so that I could power through it and get that refresh. But yeah, no, he talks about the battle Jin, that there is basically positive and negative, and then he introduces to Aang the idea that there's also neutral. And then makes a joke. He's like, wait. Aang goes, wait, there's three? He goes, well, actually, there's five. We're going to focus on these three right now. In typical Bumi fashion of just like... Yes. Very good.
Oh, man.
I want to be like him when I grow old.
Oh, my God. Mad genius. You're a mad genius, Bumi. All right.
Spiritual world. Neutrality.
Oh, yeah. So that's, I mean, Byron, you were the one who brought up that point. What were you going to say about it?
No, just going the whole idea of, like, how there's more than one way of thinking.
That's yes.
That is a big staple of Buddhism. Like,
yes.
I can go a little off topic about the subject here.
Please.
And I'm no expert on Buddhism, but I've read, like, enough of it to realize that it's not really so much a religion as it is
a lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. It's a spiritual supplement. I remember reading an excerpt from a essay online where someone said that being a Buddhist made them a better Christian.
Yes.
So in that sense, there are a lot of overlapping philosophy and ideologies in Buddhism, and there are a lot of overlapping ideologies in the world of Avatar.
Yeah. The other thing that I thought of a lot with the how Aang had the dichotomy of the, oh yeah, there's push and pull, light and dark, the positive and negative Jin, and then Bumi brought in the idea that, no, there's also neutral, and that brought Taoism to my brain, and, you know, the yin-yang symbol that everyone knows and drew on their books in middle school and whatnot, but... The yin-yang symbol is a major symbol in Taoism, and it's symbolizes the light and the dark side, and then you have those little dots, meaning that they're in balance with each other. There's a little bit of dark in the light, and there's a little bit of light in the dark, and the two fit together perfectly to create a circle, a balance. I'm not going to get into how much I talk about this, because then I'm just going to start talking about Star Wars and the Force, and that's not what we're here for. But I have very strong spiritual feelings about the Force and about balance within the Force and what the new movies are doing, and I have to stop now. But...
Great Jedi is the way.
No. I mean...
No light found.
Yes, but moving no.
On. All right, we gotta
reel that back in. We're not talking about Star Wars today. But yeah, no. So that the different djinns that you're talking about is also very Eastern spiritual philosophy of balance, of having multiple ways of looking at things and taking what you need and creating the solution in a balanced way.
Yep. And you see, I want to talk about the final battle, like the moments in the final battle. You see Aang take what he's learned, especially from that conversation, into his final battle.
Yes.
Where he finds another way.
He does. Mm-hmm. He does. And you're going through this battle thinking there's only one way that this can end. And he does something else.
Yeah.
And he does something that does not compromise his pacifist belief system.
Right.
And it's a brilliant solution. And what we're talking about, it coming at problems from different angles, is going back to bending, the reason why he had so much trouble with earthbending. Because he always tries to come at things from another angle. With earthbending, there's no way to do that. You have to stand your ground and hit it with your head. And there is no other way to come at it, which is so against everything that Aang was ever brought up believing.
Which I find interesting with Korra struggling with airbending when she was learning how to do it. Like, airbending is very, like, is fluid. It's go with the flow. Which I always found funny, considering that was kind of how Korra's personality was. She was flexible.
It was the control aspect that she lacked.
Ah, yes.
But also, like, yeah, she was easygoing, but she was also hard-headed.
Yeah.
She was impatient.
Yes.
And she was too forward.
Yes.
And so, if you compare Korra and Aang, Aang is, I don't want to say polar opposite, but he's completely different.
No, he really is. He has a lot of, he was brought up with the fluidity, but the inner peace.
That's it, yeah.
It's the inner peace, and Korra doesn't have that. She has always been, like, she's comfortable with herself, but she's never been someone who can sit down and think through what she's doing.
Yeah.
Which is why she had so much trouble with airbending, is because, yes, it's about fluid and movement and whatnot, but she was able, so is waterbending, and she was able to master that immediately. Yeah. The part of air is, again, I have to make the Star Wars metaphor, is it's about taking everything and applying the control to it and the calm to it. And that was the part that she really struggled with. Anywho, I have talked for more time than Byron talked, so we should move on.
this is another one where we could just talk about it forever.
I mean, oh, yes. when you start digging into philosophy, that's a
oh my god, yeah, no. And again, like we're all gonna have a lot of trouble really sticking to like our series and not just gushing about the series, but about the topic specifically. Why did we pick this as influenced by anime? And for Avatar, that's a very obvious choice, so we were able to really get off, not fully off track, but start talking about the philosophies of Eastern culture and whatnot, and it all fed back in, but we can move on now.
I just want to say one more thing.
Say one more thing.
Fuck M. Night Shyamalan.
Yes! Oh, I second that.
That's right. He made that horrible adaptation.
Oh my god, it was awful.
What?
It was so bad. Guys,
that, although okay. Although to be fair, that does follow anime trope, because a lot of live action anime movies suck ass.
So maybe that was on purpose.
Maybe.
Maybe yeah. It's supposed to be bad.
It's following the trend. Yeah.
Ugh, anywho, yeah, so I guess Avatar is technically old enough that if you're a young weeb listening to this, maybe you haven't seen this. Like, you assume that everyone's watched these things, but Avatar is technically old enough. I know, we're all clutching at our chests.
Yeah. My youth.
Ugh.
I think I need to adjust my dentures.
It is technically old enough that maybe you haven't seen it.
Wait, does that make me a pervy old guy?
I thought that was established, dude.
I mean, let's be honest, we're all pervy old guys in here, even the lady. but yeah, no, if you have not seen original or Korra, specifically The Last Airbender, though, watch this series. It is incredible. Stay away from the movie.
But read the comics that follow them.
Yes, the comics are great. Oh my god!
Especially the first one following Last Airbender. You find out what happens to Zuko's mom.
Yes, that's hinted at in it's hinted at in the show. And again, that was an episode that I watched like today. It's the same episode we were talking about earlier, where he's having the flashbacks in between the Kurosawa episode.
Yes.
That's when we find out that like something terrible happened to his mother, but we don't know what.
Great, another guy with mommy issues.
Yeah, right?
They're everywhere.
Well, to be fair, Zuko has mommy and daddy issues. He's just a mess.
Yes.
Zuko's a mess. My poor buddy.
Well.
Giant robots?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I'm going with the 2002 classic Megas XLR.
Fuck yes.
Oh, my God. That was, like, such a guy show, too.
It really was. That's what made it special.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a giant mech from the year 30,000 that got time displaced during a battle with an invading alien race called the Gorf.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
And this wasn't made in Japan?
No. And the giant robot crashed in a junkyard in New Jersey.
Okay.
Fucking New Jersey.
Yes.
Fucking New Jersey, man. Everything fucking
New Jersey. Sorry, I had to make the Hamilton reference. I had to.
And pretty much this guy, Coop, and his buddy Jamie just happened to say, we'll buy this heap of scrap. $5. Ends up being the mech.
Nice!
So they replaced the control center, which was the head, with looked like a 1980s muscle car.
That was
red with like flames going up.
It was a Mustang?
Yeah.
With the flames.
Yeah.
The flames!
And the original pilot from the year 30,000, Kira, came back to bring it back to the future. Great Scott. So back to the future to fight the Glorf, who happened to come back to the past just to destroy the mech, so it's not a threat to them back in the future.
Mm-hmm. Time travel. I dig it.
And pretty much 25 episodes long, 2 seasons. But it was fun while it lasted. I mean,
it was.
Yeah. What's his name? He played Ash from Evil Dead. Like
Bruce Campbell.
Yes, Bruce Campbell did a
Magnanimous. Magnanimous.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Which is pretty much like a MODOK ripoff.
Yes.
Oh, shit.
It was hilarious. Well, technically, he was like a mixture of MODOK meets Mojo from X-Men.
Yes. Yeah, he had his own little, like, televised combat arena.
Yes.
Oh, God damn it, this sounds incredible.
it was one of the best episodes of the series.
It was. So, it's follows, like, the tropes of sort of, like, Macross, well, Robotech, where you always have, like, the invading alien force, and, well, we gotta bring our super robot in to save the day.
Yep.
Yeah, it followed a lot of those tropes from, like, traditional Super Robot Monster of the Week type shows.
Yeah.
Where they come in, they beat the bad guy, and that's it. It's an easy watch because it's episodic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cool.
And it doesn't really get tiring or boring either.
No.
And what's great about it is that at the end of the day, It doesn't matter how repetitive it gets. There's always something funky and fresh at the end of it.
Exactly. And I love that art style, too.
Mm-hmm. It's very American, but, like, influenced with some Japanese in it. It's pretty...
Yeah, you can tell the mechs were, like, based on, like, Japanese, like, inspiration.
Yep.
Yes. That reminds me of one of my favorite episodes. The one where the enemies were magical girls.
Yes! Oh, man, I forgot about that one.
Oh, yeah. This show pokes fun at a lot of conventions in anime hardcore.
Oh, yeah. They make fun of everything.
Yeah.
Nothing is safe. But it does it tastefully.
Yeah, it doesn't do it in a crappy way.
Unlike Drawn Together.
Yeah. I cringe. Yeah, there's tongue-in-cheek, and then there's tongue-in-butt-cheek like them.
Yeah.
No, thank you. All done.
Yep.
I like that Megas didn't really even have, like, any weapons. He was just, like, pounding people all day.
Yeah.
Well, that's because Coop's arsenal was in his head. Like,
yeah.
he was very improvisational with his combat.
Mm-hmm. He was piling up with pure gaming skills.
Yep. Yes.
Like an old school, like, Sega controller or something like that.
Yeah, it was just the joystick and the button. That's it.
Oh, yeah, it was.
Well, yeah, because, like, in, like, shows like, in shows like that, there's always a Deus Ex Machina. Mm. There's always that giant blazing. There's always that giant blazing sword or some other variation that just comes in and finishes the enemy.
Yeah.
Coop is always like, "I'll just use this. I'll just use the sewage pipe and drown the circuits out."
Yep.
Oh, so he uses mostly, rather than having his one leg, super move, super weapon, he just always uses found weapons.
Yes.
Yep. Nice, I love it.
And like I was saying earlier, Megas doesn't have any weapons, he just grounds and pounds everybody.
Yeah.
Yes. And that just made it so cool.
Alright, so, my choice for this evening is Samurai Jack.
Watch out!
Yeah!
Gotta get back to the best Samurai Jack!
So,
really obvious pick, yeah. But real good.
Other than having an awesome intro, like other animes, they use a lot of, I want to say, samurai movie angles and a lot of samurai techniques.
Techniques, sure. And
they use a lot of those techniques where they'll zoom in on like a specific body part. So it'll be and it's Jack focusing on the enemy, or it'll be his ear and his ear is like twitching because he's like listening in for the enemy or something like that. So the one episode I remember so vividly is one where he has to storm this fortress because there are all these
archers.
Yeah, there are all these archers, and he can't get close because they're just able to pick him off.
Sure.
So he starts dodging or whatever, and he realizes he can't get in there. So what he does is that he makes himself blind because he realizes that the archers are blind. They're using their senses.
He tried to blind them with the sunlight and the sword.
Exactly, and it didn't work.
Ha ha ha.
So he wraps his sash around his eyes. He takes off his robe so he can be light and nimble, and he only has his sword. And then next thing you know, here he is. You know, he's hearing his footsteps in the snow, and he's hearing their bow twang. So he's like, all right, now I know I have to move. So he starts moving, dodging left and right, and like he's able to vanquish them. But what's so awesome about this TV show was that, you know, not only is it American adapting Japanese anime styles, but it also adapts Japanese cinematic styles.
Honestly, I would say it's more into the samurai cinematic style, because the animation style itself is very sharp and blocky.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is super cool, but not what you think of when you think of traditional anime animation.
Right. And just the aesthetics, the music, the action sequences, and some of the, I mean, tropes are going to be the same across cultures, but, you know, focusing it on a samurai is what really makes it stand out. So, you know, there's this one episode where he meets the Spartans, the 300 Spartans, because they get lost in time, kind of like he does. There's another episode where he meets the Scotsman, who's almost like a badass Viking instead of a Scotsman, but it kind of hints at him being William Wallace, and he's like this man out of time doing something that's timeless, which is seeking revenge.
Yeah,
and it's just so amazing because they're able to use so many different cinematic techniques that are from Japan and different tropes that you see that are heavy in Japanese anime, and that's why I chose it.
It's a great one. They also, going back to the Eastern views on spirits and spirit world, and specifically the aesthetics of demons, Aku is such a like stylized Eastern demon. It is not something that would come out of the... He does not look like the devil.
Beautiful samurai!
Oh my god, yeah.
You dare to defy me?
Aku!
A shape-shifting master of evil!
he goes up against a lot of really interesting demons throughout this series in his revenge hunt against Aku, and it's...
They make for some really interesting standalone episodes, too.
Yeah.
Like, when we can't... I can't talk about Samurai Jack without talking about my favorite episode, which the name escapes me, but it's the one where he's fighting the ninja that's hiding in the shadows, and the way that Jack counteracts him is by wrapping his kimono all around him, basically making him all white, and it turns into one of the greatest moments in animation ever.
It almost becomes like spy versus spy.
Yeah, the very clear cut good versus bad, dark versus white, yes. Like that dichotomy.
Yes.
Always with the visual dichotomy.
It was just pure art. I cannot use any other word to describe that fight.
Well,
it's a testament to animation in and of itself.
And I can just like feel the drum beat because what's awesome about the action sequences is they have this marvelous like soundtrack. It's like.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. They really focus on the beat. Don't have orchestral and orchestral sounds can be used very effectively too. But because of the minimalist style of the animation, the minimalist just work. Basically,
it's all percussion.
Yeah. It's all percussion. And it shows the beats.
Films.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It shows the heartbeat. It shows the beats in the fight. It shows. It's really, really cool.
Yes.
Yeah, Samurai Jack is actually a really, honestly, it's a great study in minimalism in animation.
I was thinking of that too because like the line, like even the line work, like.
It's all very sharp. It's very blocky. It's very minimalist.
I remember when I saw the first episode on Cartoon Network, and they did like a little bio afterwards, and Genndy Tartakovsky talked about how he did that on purpose. He wanted to do something that would really stand out, and it took him years to finally realize his full vision, but I'll be damned if it didn't pay off.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's incredible, because having the eye is still drawn to the animation style, but it's not distracted by it.
It's not overwhelmed.
It's not overwhelming. It's not a Miyazaki style where you're panning over this beautiful vista and it's all that you can focus on rather than the words being said.
Right.
It's like a 180 of Genndy Tartakovsky's original like animation style, because usually he does thick outlines for his characters.
Yes.
But in Samurai Jack, no outlines whatsoever.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it really makes you... Because there's not a lot to focus on in the animation, it makes you focus on the characters and the action.
Yes.
And it's great.
It almost feels like a Picasso painting in motion.
Yeah.
Sure.
And it's even the simplistic style lends its own beauty to it. I think it was Da Vinci that said the simplicity is like too beautiful or something like that. I forget the quote, but no, he said the highest form of sophistication is simplicity. That's what Da Vinci
said. There you go.
And it's definitely apparent.
Is that all you got to say about this?
You know me, I keep it light and sweet.
All right. Oh my.
Oh yeah.
This is not a family show, folks.
Runners up.
Yes, runners up. So I'm going to talk about an obscure one. One of my favorite American animators, Ciro Neely, his maiden voyage into the industry was an homage to Super Robot shows, Tokusatsu, and just anime as a whole. It was called Super Robot Monkey Team Hyper Force Go. It aired on Toon Disney initially, and the Disney Channel, and it was his main voyage, and it also was like the first big voice acting role for Greg Sipes, who has made quite a name for himself in the animation field, and has a pretty good working relationship with Ciro. But moving on, he plays Jiro, who unearths this ancient team of cybernetic monkey warriors called the Hyper Force.
I'm sorry, I literally just had like a flashback to this series.
Yes.
I forgot this existed, the title didn't jog it. You said that sentence and I went, oh my God, I remember this show.
Yes.
The Matrix has you, Neo.
Yes.
I remember watching and I was initially thrown off by it. I thought it was kind of weird, but then when I watched it, it was just so cool. It had like such amazing voice talent, like Greg Sipes, Mark Hamill playing the main villain, the Skeleton King.
God bless Mark Hamill.
Oh God, was he terrifying too? It's like, yes, he was the Joker, but he made this character his own, and you're just like, I'm gonna wet myself if he keeps talking. And Corey Feldman was one of the main characters in it too. He plays Sparks. And like I had to listen closely. I'm just like, that's Corey Feldman.
I can't believe I forgot the show existed. It just hit me like a sledgehammer.
Yeah, finding out that Corey Feldman played Sparks was like finding out Lance Bass was Sephiroth.
Mind fuck.
No, I remember that.
Boy, yes. Kicked my ass so many times.
Yep.
I knew this. I had forgotten this. Like, I just blocked that out. Oh my god, that's right. Yeah.
And then Cameron Michael Richardson, who played, I believe Otto was his name. He was, he was like the unofficial leader of the group. And that was some of his finest voice work. Like, you want someone to do a deep surly, soulful voice, you call Kevin Michael Richardson. And he and his sexual chocolate flavor, god damn. I don't know if it's on Blu-ray or not, but if you can find this gem or support anything else Sir Neely has done. He did Earth's Mightiest Heroes, which also had like his style. He did the 2012 Ninja Turtles series, which also had a lot of huge anime influence into it as well. Just watch his shit. God damn.
Yeah.
Maggie, what you got for runner up?
All right. Well, speaking of Greg Sipes' voices, I'm going to go with another really, really obvious choice. Teen Titans! And I'm not talking about fucking Go here.
No. Go I'm away, not- Go.
Yes.
About fuck
the
that!
The real one.
I'm talking about the real Teen Titans. Mm-hmm. The super anime one. What was it? Puffy AmiYumi did the intro. No. This show was, and it was a beautiful marriage of Western comic book characters. He took DC young superhero characters and threw them into an anime style. Yes. And it was great. It worked so well.
It did.
Oh my god, it's incredible because you have... I'm overwhelmed thinking about this. I love this show so much. So you have the anime style, animation style. You have a few good anime tropes in there of the, like, you know, extreme reactions.
Yes.
They turn chibi every once in a while in the animation.
Eyes.
The big eyes are like, wow! Like, the comedic anime style is really put into this. But then you also have all of... I'm a DC gal through and through. I'm literally wearing a Wonder Woman shirt right now. I'm a DC gal through and through, which is really hard nowadays. God damn it, DC is letting me down. But I love the old stuff. I love the characters in DC. I know everything there is to know about Batman. Fucking fight me.
All right, Doomsday.
I'll take that bet. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I was going to say, your profile picture is literally the bat symbol. I know, you're wearing a Flash shirt right now.
Yeah.
We got a DC heavy crew in here today.
Yeah.
So you have these Western characters that have been established, and then you throw them into the deep, sort of spiritual, conflicted style of the anime. You took something that was... I'm trying to think, because there are so many parallels between the two that they just worked so well together.
Well, so DC, for all intents and purposes, mm-hmm. is darker than Marvel. It has more adult content, even with their teenagers.
Yeah.
So,
I agree.
Taking some of those dark storylines, they're able to lighten it up with the anime, but still present it in a mature, sophisticated way.
And or I mean, season, and it worked really well as the show went on, because season one was a lot more episodic, a lot more lighthearted, and then as the seasons went on, you started getting into some really heavy shit.
Yeah. You had Robin.
Robin's struggle. Okay, you know what? Robin's struggle with Slade was season one.
Yep.
Yeah. That was season one. Robin's obsession with Slade, and then vice versa, which continues throughout the series, but really hits its height in season one because that's all we're focusing on.
Red X.
Oh my god, Red X, yes. He becomes Slade's apprentice for a while, to save his friends. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful, incredible drama, and it's beautifully rendered in the
aesthetics.
In the anime aesthetic. It's great. Raven's stuff later on.
Yeah, with her dad.
Yes. Raven's storyline. Oh my god. Beast Boy goes through some shit. Actually, season one is when you get an amazing episode with Cyborg.
Yeah.
His human half versus his robot half and his struggle to amalgamate the two and be happy with who he is
and
currently.
And underlying identity crisis. With
yeah.
Too.
Oh, no. The huge thing. Yeah, it's all about the identity crisis.
Is that the
crisis.
One where he meets that robot in the junkyard?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, and he tries to fix him by replacing all the human bits with mechanical bits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah. And then there's another episode later along... Yeah, it's not the same episode, but he continues this struggle where he's able to... He gets technology that does makes him visually look entirely human.
Yep.
So he can go out and like not be stared at.
Yep.
And that brings up that identity struggle again.
Yeah.
I think Starfire is like sees him like flexing in the mirror and she goes, "I like the original better," referring to like who he is now, and he just stares back at her and goes, "This is the original."
Yeah.
I was like, "Ah!" Yeah, no. So Teen Titans was made in a Western studio for Western audiences, but based on Western property of DC, but it's hyper anime and intentionally so, to the point where, like I said earlier, they actually got a Japanese like girl band group to do the
yes.
hyper J-pop yep. intro.
Oh my god, they're super J-pop too.
Super hyper J-pop, like bubblegum J-pop.
For me, that couldn't have happened at a better time when I was like at the height of my weebdom, too.
Mm.
So, I'm like, I want to see them in concert. I'm listening to their songs. And, like, I don't even know what streaming service, what music services were the thing at the time. Because I need Geritol. But, moving forward.
Yeah, no, I remember just being so thrilled that hearing this, like, on TV. Hearing that clear, like... nasally Japanese J-pop, and honestly, that's not my musical style. Like, it's too nasally for me. I don't love Puffy AmiYumi, but at the time, hearing them like on TV, I was like, "Oh my god, is this real life?"
I was
so excited.
TV.
Exactly,
yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
On a non-international station.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. No, this was God, who did? Cartoon Network?
Yes.
Yes.
Yep. Everything we think today was from Cartoon Network.
Nope. Avatar is Nickelodeon.
You're right. Mm-hmm. You're right.
Moving on.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm not giving an honorable mention. I'm giving a dishonorable mention because, you know, like we said, when you don't do like the live action adaptation, sometimes the animation adaptations can be garbage too.
Mm.
And I'm pointing my finger at the wonderful world of Deke. Spelled D-I-C.
Deke.
Oh, God.
Ugh. Yeah. I feel like you, in a very recent episode, talked about Deke.
No, actually, since we were going to meet last week, I was kind of sick that day, so I said in like...
Oh, that's right, yeah, you yeah, mentioned yeah. it for that. Okay, yeah, that's right.
So, anywho, the wonderful world of Deke has ruined the animation of a very beloved franchise, two separate entities... Street Fighter
mm-hmm.
and Darkstalkers.
Oh, God. Mm-hmm. Oh, God. I remember those.
They both have their own respective animes and their own bastardized, Americanized versions.
To be fair, the animes weren't that good either, but we're not talking about them.
Street Fighter, where Guile is the leader of the Street Fighter Force trying to bring down Bison and his Shadaloo terrorist organization.
Because he was the leader in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Good thing to copy.
At least they look there like they do from the video game.
Mostly.
But,
Oh.
Oh.
I remember.
Yeah. I'm bringing on the flashbacks for you guys.
Didn't they air that on USA
when they did?
They did.
They did.
Yes, they did.
Shoddy animation, hackneyed voice acting.
That was not Scott McNeil's best. No. I love you, Scott McNeil. I'm a big fan of your work.
Everybody's got to start somewhere, man.
Yeah.
Even our favorites can hurt us at times.
Yeah.
Just cuts a little deeper.
And to be fair, Scott was in both of those.
He was. Yes, he was. He was a skeleton in Darkstalkers.
He played Lord Raptor in the American cartoon and in the anime.
Oh.
He did better in the anime.
Yes, he did. That. Oh, man.
Okay, I'm going to stop stomping on my childhood lead boots now. I'm passing it off to you.
I can say one positive about Darkstalkers.
Okay.
The ending theme.
All right.
Which was taken from the anime. Trouble Man.
Yeah.
Oh, wait,
so, you know, the part that the Western animation pulled directly from anime and didn't try to adapt.
Yeah. So, I have an honorable mention as opposed to dishonorable. But
sure.
Batman, the animated series.
Yes.
It's probably been the most prolific version of Batman to have existed yet.
Especially for our generation.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It was the definitive soundtrack for the 90s.
Oh, God. Onward.
So, Batman, the animated series. It borrowed more, not necessarily from style, but, how do I say it? Again, the techniques. It borrowed more from the technical aspects of anime. In the way that you present things, in the way that you alter the styles,
mm-hmm.
and what's magnificent about it is that because it's such a dark cartoon, one of the first to show blood and gun violence.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Because it's such a dark cartoon, they kept it noir. Even though there's color, you still have deep contrasting shadows.
Oh, my God. Batman the Animated Series is super noir. Although that's still a very Western archetype.
Right. Yes. There's... So even the battles in Batman, I'm thinking more specifically against Ra's al Ghul, between Batman and
Ra's al Ghul.
Yeah, Ra's. Ra's,
well, whatever. we'll fight about this later. Yeah. But
throws a chair.
The movies messed with a lot of people's idea about what the pronunciation is.
Yeah. Remember, alright, no, I'm not...
We're not gonna get into this! How is Batman anime?
Center.
So, Batman is anime because of the way that it's presented. So, in anime, you have kind of... Alright, how do I say it? So, storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
You have your intro, your body, your conclusion. So, Batman being episodic... You have a same way that it's presented, but instead of being the American way where it's like flash and action, and then you got somebody with more action, it's presented more as an anime in the sense that you have something a bit more intellectual happening. And that just comes to the point of Batman being a more intellectual cartoon,
mm-hmm.
as an overarching thing.
Yeah.
I was
gonna say, now, because I know you can take this criticism, I'm going to say, how is that different from saying it's the noir, the intellectual, the setup that you're saying doesn't sound like something distinctly from anime to me?
So the reason why it's different from noir is because noir is too fucking slow.
Yes.
Anime isn't. Anime has enough pop and it has enough of a hook to bring you in.
Yeah.
So that's the major correlating difference between the two.
Yeah.
And so... one of the things that the creators were saying that they borrowed from anime was just the style and the almost like the performance of the cartoon as opposed to just like lines that move.
Yeah.
They put life into it using an anime style.
Mm-hmm.
I would also argue that how like even as darkest moments of the show, there's always a message of hope behind each episode, like in a lot of anime.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that might be me grasping for straws, but I see that more in anime than you could ever see in most noir stories.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
anime does more typically have the, no matter how dark things are, there's a bit of hope, versus American cartoons tend to either go for pure dark or for more happy throughout.
Mm-hmm.
You don't as often get the moral complexity of the dark situation and then that glimmer of hope.
So like the Clayface arc.
Right, right. Yes, but case in point, Spider-Man, the animated mm-hmm. series. So Spider-Man the animated series dealt with some heavy issues, but
yeah.
at the same time, it never looked that serious because of the art style.
Yes,
art style mm-hmm.
it was much brighter. Yeah. And sorry, I gotta ask now, which Spider-Man series are we talking about? Are we talking about the one that's like shown in the memes, where it's the super clunky looking art, or
that's
is it 60s, one of the newer ones? Yeah,
the 90s,
yep. the 90s one,
the 90s
not,
one.
Not
sure,
unlimited,
sure, sure, sure.
Not unlimited, because that's
or spectacular.
No.
Yeah, that's different, but. The 90s one,
yeah.
that was on Fox.
Yeah.
All the colors were a lot brighter, but when you look at Batman the Animated Series, you have deeper grays, deeper browns,
yes.
the blacks
yes.
are highlighted with blue.
It sombers the tone.
Exactly. Yeah, I always felt like it was like at night.
Even during the day.
Well, I know the reason behind that. It's because they used black paper.
Yes.
And they drew on
oh.
it.
Yep.
Yep.
Wow. Yeah, it's really, really cool. Listening to a lot of the behind-the-scenes stories about how this show got made, especially the shit they would pull on the censors.
Mm-hmm.
How the reason they got away with showing, like, blood and showing gun violence is because they would put crazy extreme stuff in there that they knew they would never get away with, and then their compromise was what they really wanted to show.
Yeah,
and the allusions to death that they had as well.
Yeah, so they
call the allusions to death. I mean, the sex jokes. I mean, the fact that a WB kids show had Harley Quinn going, "You want to rev your Harley, Mr. J?" They got that in because they had, like, in the original scripting, they put, like, almost a full-blown, like, scene
mm-hmm.
in there. Like, way more explicit. And then the joke line that they actually got was the one that they wanted, and that was the compromise. The censor said, "Well, it's not this, so go for it. That's way better." And they did that constantly.
Yeah.
They did that constantly. They would have...
That's Warner Brothers in general with their animation.
Yeah, no. They would script out the most horrifying, brutal fight scenes,
mm-hmm.
knowing that the censors would reject it, and then be able to work with them to scale it back to what they wanted in the first place, which is still mm-hmm. way more than we had ever seen on TV
right.
at this point.
And so that's the technique called hair on the arms.
Yeah.
Where when you animate something, you put really hairy arms on people, and they're like, no, we can't do that. So you get away with the things that you want to do.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. That's brilliant.
Yeah. No, it's great. And Batman the Animated Series was able to get away with so much of this because their writers and animators were masters at this. Their producers were like, this is the story we want to tell, and this is how we're going to manipulate the system to be able to tell it.
Yeah.
That brings to mind this one episode where Batman goes over to Japan, back to his old dojo.
That one ninja guy that you knew was
Bruce Wayne.
He guts the shit out of him in the cartoon. Like, you don't see, like, all the blood and whatnot, but Batman...
Still, it's, like, hyper-violent.
Slices him right across the
yeah.
gut. Crazy.
Yeah, and this was on Saturday morning on Kids WB.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
I mean, at the end of their battle, like, Batman tries to save them since the volcano's erupting and they're being surrounded by lava. Like, he tosses out the rope to save them.
I remember watching that episode on Fox Kids back when I was in fifth
passes,
grade.
And then you see nothing there.
Yep.
Oh, my God. And you want to talk about, the dark stuff. You mentioned allusions to death earlier.
Yes.
The episode where he sits with that little girl who is a human weapon and she's dying.
Oh, that was
and
Injustice
he literally
League. Yeah.
Oh, that was in Justice League.
Yeah,
you're right. But that was a Batman specific one.
Yeah.
Sorry, I got those mixed up for a minute.
I mean that
it was Paul Dini, so
Yeah, it's all Paul Dini. The animated series was the one where he went on an adventure with Harley, and in the end, after turning her into Arkham, he buys her the dress that she wanted.
Yeah,
and
yes.
that's, again, so, the, like, he brought her in, he took her down, he did his job, but he still has that glimmer of hope, that ounce of, I have humanity, and I know that you have humanity, and I'm going to do this small gesture to speak to that humanity.
Right, so that's, see, this is one thing, as a super huge Batman fan,
mm-hmm.
I get upset with people all the time is they think that Batman is just a crime fighter. No, he's trying to rehabilitate people.
Yes!
That's why he brings them to Arkham Asylum, because Arkham Asylum isn't just like a loony bin. It's a place for people to get help.
It's so interesting watching, again, we got to stick on topic, but we could talk for a really long time about the different iterations of Batman and Gotham in the various comics and the various movies and TV IPs. Shows and whatnot, and how different people have come at that. And my good friend Jude, who's actually the person who really got me into DC Comics and Batman, basically has a Batman litmus test where after watching any Batman property, they then look at it and say, okay, would this Batman buy Harley the dress? Mm. And that's the sort of litmus test about, is this Batman?
Yeah.
Did they take the dark and the gritty and the trauma, but include that little bit of humanity, which a lot of people, especially nowadays, are leaving out that bit of humanity?
Yeah, they don't. They just can't conceptualize.
It's incredibly frustrating!
Can you do that test with Batman Ninja?
Oh, yeah.
You know, that was pretty dope. That was pretty dope.
There wasn't enough of a story to apply that litmus test to that one. <That's true. laughs>
But anyways, Batman the Animated Series uses anime techniques in its storytelling style.
Yeah.
Yes. Agreed.
Oh, yes.
Ta-da! We did it!
We found a way! That is some hardcore bullshitting there. And
I don't, no. Back it up.
It was a joke. It was a joke. Step off.
Hey, it's cooperative bullshitting.
I was in on this. I'm all for this, man. Don't attack me.
Hands up, don't shoot.
Fuck this guy especially. Oh, man.
All right, kids. Yes. We're over an hour. We should probably wrap this up.
We should wrap this bad boy up.
Yep.
All right. I'm gonna try to keep the closing speech to a minimum. Anime has influenced Western culture so much in the past decade. You see it in shows like Steven Universe, the newest version of Voltron. The forthcoming She-Ra Princess of the Power series, which I am waiting for in bated breath. God, yeah, and there are so many ways to go about it. Hell, it's Western cultures influencing anime, which are like My Hero Academia.
I was about to bring that up, as I'd be really interested in doing another episode at some point of doing Western influences on anime, because we can absolutely, oh my god, we can totally flip the script on this, because there's so much of Japanese culture that is directly from America's influence on them, basically, post-World Wars.
Yeah, the Americana factor.
Exactly. As fascinated as we are with Japanese culture and how that shows up in a lot of our animation, it goes exactly the other way, too. A lot of, if you walk through Tokyo, there's a lot of stuff they picked up and borrowed from Western culture and made their own.
Yeah, I mean, some of the most popular movies in Japan are Western films.
Yep.
Anime isn't really all that popular in Japan.
Yeah, it's like soap opera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just there, you know? It's not mainstream. And as fans of both, for everyone in this room, it is a great time to be alive. It's an embarrassment of riches. And it makes for... It allows us to have these kind of episodes, to have these kind of discussions. And I feel like we should come back to it in a future episode, honestly.
I think so, yeah. The world is small and cultural exchange is real. And we should look at the flip side of this coin sometime.
Absolutely. And on that note, this is Byron D0. I'm forgetting myself. Saying goodnight before the rest of my brain rots away from senility.
Maggle B, see y'all later.
This is Mechanical here, asking, please hook me up the flux capacitor.
Ugh.
Battery low.
Megatron here, signing off.
Look for us on the social media, guys.
Night, y'all.
Bye. Yeah.